This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Brisinger, or The Seven Promises of Aragorn Shadeslayer and Saphira Bjartskuler. Inheritance, Book 3, by Christopher Paolini. Read for you by Gerard Doyle, with an exclusive interview between Christopher Paolini and his editor Michelle Fry, immediately following the program. The Gates of Death. Aragorn stared at the dark tower of stone wherein hid the monsters who had murdered his uncle, Garrow. He was lying on his belly behind the edge of a sandy hill, dotted with sparse blades of grass, thorn bushes, and small rosebud-like cactuses. The brittle stems of last year's foliage pricked his palms as he inched forward to gain a better view of Hellgrind, which loomed over the surrounding land like a black dagger thrust out from the bowels of the earth. The evening sun streaked the low hills with shadows long and narrow, and far in the west illuminated the surface of Leona Lake so that the horizon became a rippling bar of gold. To his left, Aragorn heard the steady breathing of his cousin, Roran, who was stretched out beside him. The normally inaudible flow of air seemed preternaturally loud to Aragorn, with his heightened sense of hearing. One of many such changes wrought by his experience during the Agaiti Blodron, the elves' blood oath celebration. He paid little attention to that now, as he watched a column of people inch toward the base of Hellgrind, apparently having walked from the city of Dras Leona, some miles away. A contingent of 24 men and women, garbed in thick leather robes, occupied the head of the column. This group moved with many strange and varied gaits. They limped and shuffled and humped and wriggled. They swung on crutches or used arms to propel themselves forward on curiously short legs. Contortions that were necessary because, as Aragorn realized, every one of the 24 lacked an arm or a leg, or some combination thereof. Their leader sat upright upon a litter borne by 6 oiled slaves, a pose Aragorn regarded as a rather amazing accomplishment, considering that the man, or woman, he could not tell which, consisted of nothing more than a torso and head, upon whose brow balanced an ornate leather crest, 3 feet high. "The priests of Hellgrind," he murmured to Roran. "Can they use magic?" "Possibly. I dare not explore Hellgrind with my mind until they leave, for if any are magicians, they will sense my touch however light, and our presence will be revealed." Behind the priests trudged a double line of young men swathed in gold cloth. Each carried a rectangular metal frame, subdivided by 12 horizontal crossbars, from which hung iron bells the size of winter rutabagas. Half of the young men gave their frames a vigorous shake when they stepped forward with their right foot, producing a dolorous cacophony of notes, while the other half shook their frames when they advanced upon the left foot, causing iron tongues to crash against iron throats and emit a mournful clamour that echoed over the hills. The acolytes accompanied the throbbing of the bells with their own cries, groaning and shouting in an ecstasy of passion. At the rear of the grotesque procession trudged a comet's tail of inhabitants from Dras Leona. Nobles, merchants, tradesmen, several high-ranking military commanders, and a motley collection of those less fortunate, such as labourers, beggars, and common foot soldiers. Aragorn wondered if Dras Leona's governor, Marcus Tabor, was somewhere in their midst. Drawing to a stop at the edge of the precipitous mound of scree that ringed Hellgrind, the priests gathered on either side of a rust-coloured boulder with a polished top. When the entire column stood motionless before the crude altar, the creature upon the litter stirred and began to chant in a voice as discordant as the moaning of the bells. The shaman's declamations were repeatedly truncated by gusts of wind, but Aragorn caught snatches of the ancient language, strangely twisted and mispronounced, interspersed with dwarf and Urgal words, all of which were united by an archaic dialect of Aragon's own tongue. What he understood caused him to shudder, for the sermon spoke of things best left unknown, of a malevolent hate that had festered for centuries in the dark caverns of people's hearts, before being allowed to flourish in the rider's absence, of blood and madness, and of foul rituals performed underneath a black moon. At the end of that depraved oration, two of the lesser priests rushed forward and lifted their master, or mistress as the case might be, off the litter and onto the face of the altar. Then the high priest issued a brief order. Twin blades of steel winked like stars as they rose and fell. A rivulet of blood sprang from each of the high priest's shoulders, flowed down the leather-encased torso, and then pooled across the boulder until it overflowed onto the gravel below. Two more priests jumped forward to catch the crimson flow in goblets that, when filled to the rim, were distributed among the members of the congregation, who drank eagerly. "Gah," said Roran in an undertone. "You failed to mention that those errant fleshmongers, those gore-bellied, boggle-minded idiot worshippers, were cannibals." "Not quite. They do not partake of the meat." When all the attendees had wet their throats, the servile novitiates returned the high priest to the litter and bound the creature's shoulders with strips of white linen. Wet blotches quickly sullied the virgin cloth. The wounds seemed to have no effect upon the high priest, for the limbless figure rotated back toward the devotees with their lips of cranberry red and pronounced, "Now are you truly my brothers and sisters, having tasted the sap of my veins here in the shadow of almighty Hellgrind. Blood calls to blood, and if ever your family should need help, do then what you can for the church and for others who acknowledge the power of our dread Lord, to affirm and reaffirm our fealty to the triumvirate. Recite with me the nine oaths. By Gorm, Ilda, and Fel Angvara, we vow to perform homage at least thrice a month in the hour before dusk, and then to make an offering of ourselves to appease the eternal hunger of our great and terrible Lord. We vow to observe the strictures as they are presented in the Book of Tosk. We vow to always carry our bregner on our bodies, and to forever abstain from the 12 of 12s and the touch of a many-knotted rope, lest it corrupt." A sudden rise in the wind obscured the rest of the high priest's list. Then Aragon saw those who listened take out a small curved knife, and one by one cut themselves in the crook of their elbows and anoint the altar with a stream of their blood. Some minutes later the angry breeze subsided, and Aragon again heard the priest, "And such things as you long and lust for will be granted to you as a reward for your obedience. Our worship is complete. However, if any now stand among you who are brave enough to demonstrate the true depth of their faith, let them show themselves." The audience stiffened and leaned forward, their faces rapt. This, apparently, was what they had been waiting for. For a long, silent pause, it seemed as if they would be disappointed. But then one of the acolytes broke ranks and shouted, "I will!" With a roar of delight, his brethren began to brandish their bells in a quick and savage beat, whipping the congregation into such a frenzy they jumped and yelled as if they had taken leave of their senses. The rough music kindled a spark of excitement in Aragon's heart, despite his revulsion at the proceedings, waking some primal and brutish part of him. Shedding his gold robes so that he wore nothing but a leather breechcloth, the dark-haired youth sprang on top of the altar. Gouts of ruby spray erupted on either side of his feet. He faced Hellgrind and began to shiver and quake as if stricken with palsy, keeping time with the tolling of the cruel iron bells. His head rolled loosely upon his neck, Foam gathered at the corners of his mouth, his arms thrashed like snakes. Sweat oiled his muscles until he gleamed like a bronze statue in the dying light. The bells soon reached a manic tempo, where one note clashed against another, at which point the young man thrust a hand out behind himself. Into it, a priest deposited the hilt of a bizarre implement. A single-edged weapon 2.5 feet long, with a full tang, scale grips, a vestigial crossguard, and a broad, flat blade that widened and was scalloped near the end, a shape reminiscent of a dragon wing. It was a tool designed for but one purpose, to hack through armor and bones and sinew as easily as through a bulging waterskin. The young man lifted the weapon so that it slanted toward the highest peak of Hellgrind. Then he dropped to one knee, and with an incoherent cry brought the blade down across his right wrist. Blood sprayed the rocks behind the altar. Aragorn winced and averted his eyes, although he could not escape the youth's piercing screams. It was nothing Aragorn had not seen in battle, but it seemed wrong to deliberately mutilate yourself when it was so easy to become disfigured in everyday life. Blades of grass rasped against one another as Roran shifted his weight. He muttered some curse which was lost in his beard, and then fell silent again. While a priest tended to the young man's wound, stanching the bleeding with a spell, an acolyte let loose 2 slaves from the high priest's litter, only to chain them by the ankles to an iron loop embedded in the altar. Then the acolytes divested themselves of numerous packages from underneath their robes and piled them on the ground, out of reach of the slaves. Their ceremonies at an end, the priests and their retinue departed Hellgrind for Dras Leona, wailing and ringing the entire way. The now one-handed zealot stumbled along just behind the high priest. A beatific smile graced his face. "Well," said Aragorn, and released his pent-up breath as the column vanished behind a distant hill.
"Well, what?"
"I've travelled among both dwarves and elves, and nothing they did was ever as strange as what those people, those humans, do. They're as monstrous as the Razak." Roran jerked his chin toward Hellgrind. "Can you find out now if Katrina is in there?" "I'll try, but be ready to run."
Closing his eyes, Aragorn slowly extended his consciousness outward, moving from the mind of one living thing to another, like tendrils of water seeping through sand. He touched teeming cities of insects frantically scurrying about their business, lizards and snakes hidden among warm rocks, diverse species of songbirds, and numerous small mammals. Insects and animals alike bustled with activity as they prepared for the fast approaching night, whether by retreating to their various dens or, in the case of those of a nocturnal bent, by yawning, stretching, and otherwise readying themselves to hunt and forage. Just as with his other senses, Aragorn's ability to touch another being's thoughts diminished with distance. By the time his psychic probe arrived at the base of Hellgrind, he could perceive only the largest of animals, and even those but faintly. He proceeded with caution, ready to withdraw at a second's notice if he happened to brush against the minds of their prey. The Razak, and the Razak's parents and steeds, the gigantic Leatherblucker. Aragorn was willing to expose himself in this manner only because none of the Razak's breed could use magic, and he did not believe that they were mindbreakers, non-magicians trained to fight with telepathy. The Razak and Leatherblucker had no need for such tricks, when their breath alone could induce a stupor in the largest of men. And though Aragorn risked discovery by his ghostly investigation, he, Roran, and Saphira had to know if the Razak had imprisoned Katrina, Roran's betrothed, in Hellgrind, for the answer would determine whether their mission was one of rescue or one of capture and interrogation. Aragorn searched long and hard. When he returned to himself, Roran was watching him with the expression of a starving wolf. His grey eyes burned with a mixture of anger, hope, and despair that was so great It seemed as if his emotions might burst forth and incinerate everything in sight in a blaze of unimaginable intensity, melting the very rocks themselves. This Aragorn understood. Katrina's father, the butcher Sloane, had betrayed Roran to the Razak. When they failed to capture him, the Razak had instead seized Katrina from Roran's bedroom and spirited her away from Palancar Valley, leaving the inhabitants of Carvajal to be killed and enslaved by King Galbatorix's soldiers. Unable to pursue Katrina, Roran had, just in time, convinced the villagers to abandon their homes and to follow him across the Spine and then south along the coast of Alagasia, where they joined forces with the rebel Varden. The hardships they endured as a result had been many and terrible. But circuitous as it was, that course had reunited Roran with Aragorn, who knew the location of the Razak's den, and had promised to help save Katrina. Roran had only succeeded, as he later explained, because the strength of his passion drove him to extremes that others feared and avoided, and thus allowed him to confound his enemies. A similar fervor now gripped Aragorn. He would leap into harm's way without the slightest regard for his own safety if someone he cared for was in danger. He loved Roran as a brother, and since Roran was to marry Katrina, Aragorn had extended his definition of family to include her as well. This concept seemed even more important because Aragorn and Roran were the last heirs of their line. Aragorn had renounced all affiliation with his birth brother Murtagh, and the only relatives he and Roran had left were each other. And now Katrina. Noble sentiments of kinship were not the only force that drove the pair. Another goal obsessed them as well. Revenge. Even as they plotted to snatch Katrina from the grasp of the Razak, so the two warriors, mortal man and dragon rider alike, sought to slay King Galbatorix's unnatural servants for torturing and murdering Garrow, who was Roran's father and had been as a father to Aragorn. The intelligence, then, that Aragorn had gleaned was as important to him as to Roran. "I think I felt her," he said. "It's hard to be certain because we're so far from Helgrind, and I've never touched her mind before. But I think she's in that forsaken peak, concealed somewhere near the very top. Is she sick? Is she injured? Blasted Aragorn, don't hide it from me! Have they hurt her?" "She's in no pain at the moment. More than that, I cannot say, for it required all my strength just to make out the glow of her consciousness. I could not communicate with her." Aragorn refrained from mentioning, however, that he had detected a second person as well, one whose identity he suspected, and the presence of whom, if confirmed, troubled him greatly. "What I didn't find were the Razak or the Leatherblaka. Even if I somehow overlooked the Razak, their parents are so large, their life force should blaze like 1,000 lanterns, even as Saphira's does. Aside from Katrina and a few other dim specks of light, Helgrind is black, black, black." Roran scowled, clenched his left fist, and glared at the mountain of rock, which was fading into the dusk as purple shadows enveloped it. In a low, flat voice, as if talking with himself, he said, "It doesn't matter whether you are right or wrong."
"How so?"
"We dare not attack tonight. Night is when the Razak are strongest, and if they are nearby, it would be stupid to fight them when we're at a disadvantage. Agreed?"
"Yes."
"So we wait for the dawn." Roran gestured toward the slaves chained to the gory altar. "If those poor wretches are gone by then, we know the Razak are here, and we proceed as planned. If not, we curse our bad luck that they escaped us, free the slaves, rescue Katrina, and fly back to the Varden with her before Murtagh hunts us down. Either way, I doubt the Razak will leave Katrina unattended for long. Not if Galbatorix wants her to survive, so he can use her as a tool against me." Aragorn nodded. He wanted to release the slaves now, but doing so could warn their foes that something was amiss. nor, if the Razak came to collect their dinner, could he and Saphira intercede before the slaves were ferried away. A battle in the open between a dragon and creatures such as the Leatherblucker would attract the attention of every man, woman, and child for leagues around. And Aragorn did not think he, Saphira, or Rohan could survive if Galbatorix learned they were alone in his empire. He looked away from the shackled men. "For their sake, I hope the Razak are on the other side of Alagazia, or at least that the Razak aren't hungry tonight." By unspoken consent, Aragorn and Rohan crawled backward down from the crest of the low hill they were hiding behind. At the bottom, they rose into a half-crouch, then turned, and still doubled over, ran between two rows of hills. The shallow depression gradually deepened into a narrow, flood-carved gully, lined with crumbling slabs of shale. Dodging the gnarled juniper trees that dotted the gully, Aragorn glanced up, and through clumps of needles, saw the first constellations to adorn the velvet sky. They seemed cold and sharp, like bright shards of ice. Then he concentrated on maintaining his footing, as he and Rohan trotted south toward their camp.
Around the campfire. The low mound of coals throbbed like the heart of some giant beast. Occasionally a patch of gold sparks flared into existence and raced across the surface of the wood before vanishing into a white-hot crevice. The dying remnants of the fire Aragorn and Rohan had built cast a dim red light over the surrounding area, revealing a patch of rocky soil, a few pewter-grey bushes, the indistinct mass of a juniper tree farther off, then nothing. Aragorn sat with his bare feet extended toward the nest of ruby embers, enjoying the warmth, and with his back propped against the knobby scales of Saphira's thick right foreleg. Opposite him, Rohan was perched on the iron-hard, sun-bleached, wind-worn shell of an ancient tree trunk. Every time he moved, the trunk produced a bitter shriek that made Aragorn want to claw at his ears. For the moment, quiet reigned within the hollow. Even the coals smouldered in silence. Rohan had collected only long-dead branches devoid of moisture to eliminate any smoke that unfriendly eyes might spot. Aragorn had just finished recounting the day's activities to Saphira. Normally, he never had to tell her what he had been doing, as thoughts, feelings, and other sensations flowed between them as easily as water from one side of a lake to another. But in this instance it was necessary, because Aragorn had kept his mind carefully shielded during the scouting expedition, aside from his disembodied foray into the Razak's lair. After a considerable gap in the conversation, Saphira yawned, exposing her rows of many fearsome teeth.
"Cruel and evil they may be, but I am impressed that the Razak can bewitch their prey into wanting to be eaten. They are great hunters to do that. Perhaps I shall attempt it some day."
"But not," Aragorn felt compelled to add, "with people. Try it with sheep instead."
"People, sheep, what difference is there to a dragon?"
Then she laughed deep in her long throat, a rolling rumble that reminded him of thunder. Leaning forward to take his weight off Saphira's sharp-edged scales, Aragorn picked up the hawthorn staff that lay by his side. He rolled it between his palms, admiring the play of light over the polished tangle of roots at the top and the much-scratched metal ferrule and spike at the base. Rohan had thrust the staff into his arms before they left the Varden on the burning plains, saying, "Here. Fisk made this for me after the Razak bit my shoulder. I know you lost your sword, and I thought you might have need of it. If you want to get another blade, that's fine, too. But I've found there are very few fights you can't win with a few whacks from a good, strong stick." Remembering the staff Brom had always carried, Aragorn had decided to forego a new sword in favor of the length of knotted hawthorn. After losing Zarok, he felt no desire to take up another, lesser sword. That night he had fortified both the knotted hawthorn and the handle to Roran's hammer, with several spells that would prevent either piece from breaking, except under the most extreme stress. Unbidden, a series of memories overwhelmed Aragorn. A sullen orange and crimson sky swirled around him as Saphira dove in pursuit of the red dragon and his rider. Wind howled past his ears. His fingers went numb from the jolt of sword striking sword as he dueled that same rider on the ground. Tearing off his foe's helm in the midst of combat to reveal his once friend and travelling companion Murtagh, whom he had thought dead. The sneer upon Murtagh's face as he took Zarok from Aragorn, claiming the red sword by right of inheritance as Aragorn's elder brother. Aragorn blinked, disoriented, as the noise and fury of battle faded, and the pleasant aroma of juniper wood replaced the stench of blood. He ran his tongue over his upper teeth, trying to eradicate the taste of bile that filled his mouth. Murtagh. The name alone generated a welter of confused emotions in Aragorn. On one hand, he liked Murtagh. Murtagh had saved Aragorn and Saphira from the Razak after their first ill-fated visit to Dras Leona, risked his life to help extricate Aragorn from Gilead, acquitted himself honorably in the Battle of Farthan Dûr, and, despite the torments he no doubt endured as a result, had chosen to interpret his orders from Galbatorix in a way that allowed him to release Aragorn and Saphira after the Battle of the Burning Plains, instead of taking them captive. It was not Murtagh's fault that the twins had abducted him, that the red dragon Thorn had hatched for him, or that Galbatorix had discovered their true names with which he extracted oaths of fealty in the ancient language from both Murtagh and Thorn. None of that could be blamed on Murtagh. He was a victim of fate, and had been since the day he was born. And yet, Murtagh might serve Galbatorix against his will, and he might abhor the atrocities the king forced him to commit. But some part of him seemed to revel in wielding his newfound power. During the recent engagement between the Varden and the Empire on the Burning Plains, Murtagh had singled out the dwarf king Hrothgar and slain him, although Galbatorix had not ordered Murtagh to do so. He had let Aragorn and Saphira go, yes, but only after defeating them in a brutal contest of strength and then listening to Aragorn plead for their freedom. And Murtagh had derived entirely too much pleasure from the anguish he inflicted upon Aragorn by revealing they were both sons of Morzan, first and last of the 13 dragon riders, the Forsworn, who had betrayed their compatriots to Galbatorix. Now, 4 days after the battle, another explanation presented itself to Aragorn. Perhaps what Murtagh enjoyed was watching another person shoulder the same terrible burden he had carried his whole life. Whether or not that was true, Aragorn suspected Murtagh had embraced his new role for the same reason that a dog who has been whipped without cause will someday turn and attack his master. Murtagh had been whipped and whipped, and now he had his chance to strike back at a world that had shown him little enough kindness. Yet no matter what good might still flicker in Murtagh's breast, he and Aragorn were doomed to be mortal enemies, for Murtagh's promises in the ancient language bound him to Galbatorix with unbreakable fetters, and would forevermore. If only he hadn't gone with Arjahad to hunt Urgals underneath Farthan Dûr. Or if I had just been a little faster, the twins...
Aragorn, said Saphira.
He caught himself and nodded, grateful for her intervention. Aragorn did his best to avoid brooding upon Murtagh or their shared parents, but such thoughts often waylaid him when he least expected it. Drawing and releasing a slow breath to clear his head, Aragorn tried to force his mind back to the present, but could not. The morning after the massive battle on the Burning Plains, when the Varden were busy regrouping and preparing to march after the Empire's army, which had retreated several leagues up the Jeet River, Aragorn had gone to Nasuada and Arya, explained Roran's predicament, and sought their permission to help his cousin. He did not succeed. Both women vehemently opposed what Nasawada described as a harebrained scheme that will have catastrophic consequences for everyone in Alagazia if it goes awry. The debate raged on for so long, at last Saphira had interrupted with a roar that shook the walls of the command tent. Then she said,
"I am sore and tired, and Aragorn is doing a poor job of explaining himself. We have better things to do than stand around yammering like jackdaws, no? Good. Now listen to me."
It was, reflected Aragorn, difficult to argue with a dragon. The details of Saphira's remarks were complex, but the underlying structure of her presentation was straightforward. Saphira supported Aragorn because she understood how much the proposed mission meant to him, while Aragorn supported Roran because of love and family, and because he knew Roran would pursue Katrina with or without him, and his cousin would never be able to defeat the Razak by himself. Also, so long as the Empire held Katrina captive, Roran, and through him Aragorn, was vulnerable to manipulation by Galbatorix. If the usurper threatened to kill Katrina, Roran would have no choice but to submit to his demands. It would be best, then, to patch this breach in their defences before their enemies took advantage of it. As for the timing, it was perfect. Neither Galbatorix nor the Razak would expect a raid in the center of the Empire when the Vardan were busy fighting Galbatorix's troops near the border of Surda. Murtagh and Thorn had been seen flying toward Urubane, no doubt to be chastised in person, and Nasawada and Arya agreed with Aragorn that those two would probably then continue northward to confront Queen Islanzadi and the army under her command, once the Elves made their first strike and revealed their presence. And if possible, it would be good to eliminate the Razak before they started to terrorize and demoralize the Vardan's warriors. Saphira had then pointed out, in the most diplomatic of terms, that if Nasawada asserted her authority as Aragorn's liegelord and forbade him from participating in the sortie, it would poison their relationship with the sort of rancor and dissent that could undermine the Vardan's cause.
"But," said Saphira, "the choice is yours. Keep Aragorn here if you want. However, his commitments are not mine, and I, for one, have decided to accompany Roran. It seems like a fine adventure."
A faint smile touched Aragorn's lips as he recalled the scene. The combined weight of Saphira's declaration and her impregnable logic had convinced Nasawada and Arya to grant their approval, albeit grudgingly. Afterward, Nasawada had said,
"We are trusting your judgment in this, Aragorn, Saphira. For your sake and ours, I hope this expedition goes well."
Her tone left Aragorn uncertain whether her words represented a heartfelt wish or a subtle threat. Aragorn had spent the rest of that day gathering supplies, studying maps of the Empire with Saphira, and casting what spells he felt were necessary, such as one to thwart attempts by Galbatorix or his minions to scry Roran. The following morning, Aragorn and Roran had climbed onto Saphira's back, and she had taken flight, rising above the orange clouds that stifled the burning plains and angling northeast. She flew non-stop until the sun had traversed the dome of the sky and extinguished itself behind the horizon, and then burst forth again with a glorious conflagration of reds and yellows. The first leg of their journey carried them toward the edge of the Empire, which few people inhabited. There they turned west, toward Dras Leona and Helgrind. From then on, they travelled at night, to avoid notice by anyone in the many small villages scattered across the grasslands that lay between them and their destination. Aragorn and Roran had to swathe themselves in cloaks and furs and wool mittens and felted hats, for Saphira chose to fly higher than the ice-bound peaks of most mountains, where the air was thin and dry and stabbed at their lungs, so that if a farmer tending a sick calf in the field, or a sharp-eyed watchman making his rounds, should happen to look up as she passed overhead, Sapphira would appear no larger than an eagle. Everywhere they went, Eragon saw evidence of the war that was now afoot. Camps of soldiers, wagons full of supplies gathered into a bunch for the night, and lines of men with iron collars being led from their homes to fight on Galbatorix's behalf. The amount of resources deployed against them was daunting indeed. Near the end of the second night, Helgrind had appeared in the distance, a mass of splintered columns, vague and ominous in the ashen light that precedes dawn. Sapphira had landed in the hollow where they were now, and they had slept through most of the past day before beginning their reconnaissance. A fountain of amber motes billowed and swirled as Roran tossed a branch onto the disintegrating coals. He caught Aragorn's look and shrugged. "Cold," he said. Before Aragorn could respond, he heard a slithering, scraping sound, akin to someone drawing a sword. He did not think. He flung himself in the opposite direction, rolled once, and came up into a crouch, lifting the hawthorn staff to deflect an oncoming blow. Roran was nearly as fast. He grabbed his shield from the ground, scrambled back from the log he had been sitting on, and drew his hammer from his belt, all in the span of a few seconds. They froze, waiting for the attack. Aragorn's heart pounded and his muscles trembled as he searched the darkness for the slightest hint of motion.
"I smell nothing," said Sapphira.
When several minutes elapsed without incident, Aragorn pushed his mind out over the surrounding landscape. "No one," he said, reaching deep within himself to the place where he could touch the flow of magic. He uttered the words, "Brisingr Raudr." A pale, red weirlight popped into existence several feet in front of him and remained there, floating at eye level and painting the hollow with a watery radiance. He moved slightly, and the weirlight mimicked his motion, as if connected to him by an invisible pole. Together, he and Roran advanced toward where they'd heard the sound, down the gulch that wound eastward. They held their weapons high and paused between each step, ready to defend themselves at any moment. About 10 yards from their camp, Roran held up a hand, stopping Aragorn, then pointed at a plate of shale that lay on top of the grass. It appeared conspicuously out of place. Kneeling, Roran rubbed a smaller fragment of shale across the plate and created the same steely scrape they had heard before.
"It must have fallen," said Aragorn, examining the sides of the gulch.
He allowed the weirlight to fade into oblivion. Roran nodded and stood, brushing dirt from his pants. As he walked back to Sapphira, Aragorn considered the speed with which they had reacted. His heart still contracted into a hard, painful knot with each beat. His hands shook, and he felt like dashing into the wilderness and running several miles without stopping.
"We wouldn't have jumped like that before," he thought.
The reason for their vigilance was no mystery. Every one of their fights had chipped away at their complacency, leaving behind nothing but raw nerves that twitched at the slightest touch. Roran must have been entertaining similar thoughts, for he said,
"Do you see them?"
"Who?"
"The men you've killed. Do you see them in your dreams?"
"Sometimes." The pulsing glow from the coals lit Roran's face from below, forming thick shadows above his mouth and across his forehead, and giving his heavy, half-lidded eyes a baleful aspect. He spoke slowly, as if he found the words difficult. "I never wanted to be a warrior. I dreamed of blood and glory when I was younger, as every boy does, but the land was what was important to me. That and our family. And now I have killed. I have killed and killed. And you have killed even more." His gaze focused on some distant place only he could see. "There were these two men in Narda. Did I tell you this before?" He had, but Aragorn shook his head and remained silent.
They were guards at the main gate. Two of them, you know. And the man on the right, he had pure white hair. I remember, because he couldn't have been more than 24, 25. They wore Galbatorix's sigil, but spoke as if they were from Narda. They weren't professional soldiers. They were probably just men who had decided to help protect their homes from Urgals, pirates, brigands. We weren't going to lift a finger against them. I swear to you, Aragorn, that was never part of our plan. I had no choice, though. They recognized me. I stabbed the white-haired man underneath his chin. It was like when Father cut the throat of a pig. And then the other. I smashed open his skull. I can still feel his bones giving way. I remember every blow I've landed, from the soldiers in Carvajal to the ones on the burning plains. You know, when I close my eyes, sometimes I can't sleep because the light from the fire we set in the docks of Tirm is so bright in my mind. I think I'm going mad, then. Aragorn found his hands gripping the staff with such force his knuckles were white and tendons ridged the insides of his wrists. "Aye," he said. "At first it was just Urgals. Then it was men and Urgals, and now this last battle. I know what we do is right, but right doesn't mean easy. Because of who we are, the Varden expect Saphira and me to stand at the front of their army and to slaughter entire battalions of soldiers. We do. We have." His voice caught, and he fell silent.
"Turmoil accompanies every great change," said Saphira to both of them. "And we have experienced more than our share, for we are agents of that very change. I am a dragon, and I do not regret the deaths of those who endanger us. Killing the guards in Narda may not be a deed worthy of celebration, but neither is it one to feel guilty about. You had to do it. When you must fight, Roran, does not the fierce joy of combat lend wings to your feet? Do you not know the pleasure of pitting yourself against a worthy opponent, and the satisfaction of seeing the bodies of your enemies piled before you? Aragorn, you have experienced this. Help me explain it to your cousin."
Aragorn stared at the coals. She had stated a truth that he was reluctant to acknowledge, lest by agreeing that one could enjoy violence, he would become a man he would despise. So he was mute. Across from him, Roran appeared similarly affected. In a softer voice, Saphira said,
"Do not be angry. I did not intend to upset you. I forget sometimes that you are still unaccustomed to these emotions. While I have fought tooth and nail for survival since the day I hatched."
Rising to his feet, Aragorn walked to their saddlebags and retrieved the small earthenware jar Oric had given him before they parted, then poured two large mouthfuls of raspberry mead down his gullet. Warmth bloomed in his stomach. Grimacing, Aragorn passed the jar to Roran, who also partook of the concoction. Several drinks later, when the mead had succeeded in tempering his black mood, Aragorn said, "We may have a problem tomorrow."
"What do you mean?"
Aragorn directed his words toward Saphira as well. "Remember how I said that we, Saphira and I, could easily handle the Razak?"
"Aye."
"And so we can,"
said Saphira. "Well, I was thinking about it while we spied on Helgrind, and I'm not so sure any more. There are almost an infinite number of ways to do something with magic. For example, if I want to light a fire, I could light it with heat gathered from the air or the ground. I could create a flame out of pure energy. I could summon a bolt of lightning. I could concentrate a raft of sunbeams into a single point. I could use friction, and so forth. So, the problem is, even though I can devise numerous spells to perform this one action, blocking those spells might require but a single counterspell. If you prevent the action itself from taking place, then you don't have to tailor your counterspell to address the unique properties of each individual spell.
I still don't understand what this has to do with tomorrow.
I do,
said Saphira to both of them. She had immediately grasped the implications.
It means that over the past century, Galbatorix
may have placed wards around the Razak.
That will protect them against
a whole range of spells. I probably won't
be able to kill them with any
of the words of death I was taught, nor any
attacks that we can invent now or then. We may
have to rely.
Stop, exclaimed Roran. He gave a pained smile. Stop, please. My head hurts when you do that. Aragorn paused with his mouth open. Until that moment he had been unaware that he and Saphira were speaking in turn. The knowledge pleased him. It signified that they had achieved new heights of cooperation and were acting together as a single entity, which made them far more powerful than either would be on their own. It also troubled him when he contemplated how such a partnership must, by its very nature, reduce the individuality of those involved. He closed his mouth and chuckled. Sorry. What I'm worried about is this. If Galbatorix has had the foresight to take certain precautions, then force of arms may be the only means by which we can slay the Razak. If that's true,
I'll just be in your way tomorrow.
Nonsense. You may be slower than the Razak, but I have no doubt you'll give them cause to fear your weapon, Roran Stronghammer.
The compliment seemed to please Roran.
The greatest danger for you is that the Razak or the Leatherblaker will manage to separate you from Saphira and me. The closer we stay together, the safer we'll all be. Saphira and I will try to keep the Razak and Leatherblaker occupied, but some of them may slip past us. Four against two are only good odds if you're among the four. To Saphira, Aragorn said, If I had a sword, I'm sure I could slay the Razak by myself, but I don't know if I can beat two creatures who are quick as elves using nothing but this staff.
You were the one who insisted on carrying that dry twig instead of a proper weapon, she said. Remember, I told you it might not suffice against enemies as dangerous as the Razak.
Aragorn reluctantly conceded the point.
If my spells fail us, we will be far more vulnerable than I expected. Tomorrow could end very badly indeed.
Continuing the strand of conversation he had been privy to, Roran said,
This magic is a tricky business.
The log he sat on gave a drawn-out groan as he rested his elbows on his knees.
It is, Aragorn agreed. The hardest part is trying to anticipate every possible spell. I spend most of my time asking, how can I protect myself if I'm attacked like this? And would another magician expect me to do that?
Could you make me as strong and fast as you are?
Aragorn considered the suggestion for several minutes before saying,
I don't see how. The energy needed to do that would have to come from somewhere. Saphira and I could give it to you, but then we would lose as much speed or strength as you gained.
What he did not mention was that one could also extract energy from nearby plants and animals, albeit at a terrible price, namely the deaths of the smaller beings whose life force you drew upon. The technique was a great secret, and Aragorn felt that he should not reveal it lightly, if at all. Moreover, it would be of no use to Roran, as too little grew or lived on Helgrind to fuel a man's body.
Then can you teach me to use magic?
When Aragorn hesitated, Roran added,
Not now, of course. We don't have the time, and I don't expect one can become a magician overnight anyway. But in general, why not? You and I are cousins. We share much the same blood, and it would be a valuable skill to have.
I don't know how someone who's not a rider learns to use magic, confessed Aragorn. It's not something I studied.
Glancing around, he plucked a flat, round stone from the ground and tossed it to Roran, who caught it backhand.
"Here, try this. Concentrate on lifting the rock a foot or so into the air and say, 'Stenner Riser.'"
"Stenner Riser?"
"Exactly."
Roran frowned at the stone resting on his palm, in a pose so reminiscent of Aragon's own training that Aragon could not help feeling a flash of nostalgia for the days he spent being drilled by Brom. Roran's eyebrows met, his lips tightened into a snarl, and he growled, "Stenner Riser." With enough intensity, Aragon half expected the stone to fly out of sight. Nothing happened. Scowling even harder, Roran repeated his command. "Stenner Riser." The stone exhibited a profound lack of movement.
"Well," said Aragon, "keep trying. That's the only advice I can give you. But," and here he raised a finger, "if you should happen to succeed, make sure you immediately come to me, or if I'm not around, another magician. You could kill yourself and others if you start experimenting with magic without understanding the rules. If nothing else, remember this. If you cast a spell that requires too much energy, you will die. Don't take on projects that are beyond your abilities. Don't try to bring back the dead. And don't try to unmake anything."
Roran nodded, still looking at the stone.
"Magic aside, I just realized there's something far more important that you need to learn."
"Oh?"
"Yes. You need to be able to hide your thoughts from the Black Hand, Duvrangar Gata, and others like them. You know a lot of things now that could harm the Varden. It's crucial, then, that you master this skill as soon as we return. Until you can defend yourself from spies, neither Nasuada nor I nor anyone else can trust you with information that might help our enemies."
"I understand. But why did you include Duvrangar Gata in that list? They serve you and Nasuada."
"They do. But even among our allies, there are more than a few people who would give their right arm,"
he grimaced at the appropriateness of the phrase,
"to ferret out our plans and secrets. And yours too, no less. You have become a somebody, Roran, partly because of your deeds, and partly because we are related."
"I know. It is strange to be recognized by those you have not met."
"That it is."
Several other related observations leaped to the tip of Aragon's tongue, but he resisted the urge to pursue the topic. It was a subject to explore another time.
"Now that you know what it feels like when one mind touches another, you might be able to learn to reach out and touch other minds in turn."
"I'm not sure that is an ability I want to have."
"No matter. You also might not be able to do it. Either way, before you spend time finding out, you should first devote yourself to the art of defense."
His cousin cocked an eyebrow. "How?"
"Choose something. A sound, an image, an emotion, anything, and let it swell within your mind until it blots out any other thoughts."
"That's all?"
"It's not as easy as you think. Go on, take a stab at it. When you're ready, let me know, and I'll see how well you've done."
Several moments passed. Then, at a flick of Roran's fingers, Aragon launched his consciousness toward his cousin, eager to discover what he had accomplished. The full strength of Aragon's mental ray rammed into a wall composed of Roran's memories of Katrina, and was stopped. He could take no ground, find no entrance or purchase, nor undermine the impenetrable barrier that stood before him. At that instant, Roran's entire identity was based upon his feelings for Katrina. His defenses exceeded any Aragon had previously encountered, for Roran's mind was devoid of anything else Aragon could grasp hold of and use to gain control over his cousin. Then Roran shifted his left leg, and the wood underneath released a harsh squeal. With that, the wall Aragon had hurled himself against fractured into dozens of pieces as a host of competing thoughts distracted Roran.
"What was... blast! Don't pay attention to it. He'll break through. Katrina. Remember Katrina. Ignore Aragon.
The night she agreed to marry me. The smell of the grass and her hair. Is that him? No. Focus! Don't!
Taking advantage of Roran's confusion, Aragorn rushed forward and by the force of his will immobilized Roran before he could shield himself again.
You understand the basic concept, said Aragorn,
then withdrew from Roran's mind and said out loud,
But you have to learn to maintain your concentration even when you're in the middle of a battle. You must learn to think without thinking, to empty yourself of all hopes and worries, save that one idea that is your armor. Something the elves taught me, which I have found helpful, is to recite a riddle or a piece of a poem or song. Having an action that you can repeat over and over again makes it much easier to keep your mind from straying.
I'll work on it, promised Roran. In a quiet voice, Aragorn said,
You really love her, don't you?
It was more a statement of truth and wonder than a question, the answer being self-evident, and one he felt uncertain making. Romance was not a topic Aragorn had broached with his cousin before, notwithstanding the many hours they had devoted in years past to debating the relative merits of the young women in and around Carvajal.
How did it happen?
I liked her. She liked me. What importance are the details?
Come now, said Aragorn. I was too angry to ask before you left for Therensford, and we have not seen each other again until just 4 days ago. I'm curious.
The skin around Roran's eyes pulled and wrinkled as he rubbed his temples.
There's not much to tell. I've always been partial to her. It meant little before I was a man, but after my rites of passage I began to wonder whom I would marry, and whom I wanted to become the mother of my children. During one of our visits to Carvajal, I saw Katrina stop by the side of Loring's house to pick a moss rose growing in the shade of the eaves. She smiled as she looked at the flower. It was such a tender smile, and so happy. I decided right then that I wanted to make her smile like that again and again, and that I wanted to look at that smile until the day I died. Tears gleamed in Roran's eyes, but they did not fall, and a second later he blinked, and they vanished.
I fear I have failed in that regard.
After a respectful pause, Aragorn said, You courted her, then? Aside from using me to ferry compliments to Katrina, how else did you proceed?
You ask like one who seeks instruction.
I did not. You're imagining—
Come now yourself, said Roran. I know when you're lying. You get that big foolish grin and your ears turn red. The elves may have given you a new face, but that part of you hasn't changed. What is it that exists between you and Arya?
The strength of Roran's perception disturbed Aragorn.
Nothing. The moon has addled your brain. Be honest. You dote upon her words as if each one were a diamond, and your gaze lingers upon her as if you were starving and she a grand feast arrayed an inch beyond your reach.
A plume of dark grey smoke erupted from Saphira's nostrils as she made a choking-like noise.
Aragorn ignored her suppressed merriment and said,
Arya is an elf.
And very beautiful. Pointed ears and slanted eyes are small flaws when compared with her charms. You look like a cat yourself now.
Arya is over 100 years old.
That particular piece of information caught Roran by surprise. His eyebrows went up and he said,
I find that hard to believe. She's in the prime of her youth.
It's true. Well, be that as it may, these are reasons you give me, Aragorn. And the heart rarely listens to reason. Do you fancy her or not?
If he fancied her any more,
Saphira said to both Aragorn and Roran,
I'd be trying to kiss Arya myself.
Saphira!
Mortified, Aragorn swatted her on the leg. Roran was prudent enough not to rib Aragorn further. Then answer my original question and tell me how things stand between you and Arya. Have you spoken to her or her family about this? I have found it's unwise to let such matters fester.